This is America's Sports Talk Show, Sports Byline USA. Here's Ron Barr.
As you know, I do a lot of sports book reading over the years, and I've come upon a book that I think you really will enjoy, so I hope you'll check it out. And one of the co-authors is John Florio. He joins us, and this book is about Leon and Michael Spinks, and it's called One Punch from the Promised Land. Now, this book takes a look at Leon and Michael and the myth of their heavyweight title in American culture. It also tells the story from the Spinks brothers' rise from the housing projects in St. Louis and their very divergent paths of success to the positive and negative impact that winning a heavyweight title delivered to Leon and Michael. You know, I'm going to quote from this book, John, at the very beginning because I think it kind of sets the mood for this story. You say, it started at a dead end in St. Louis, and the Pruitt-Igoe was no ordinary housing disaster. It was mean streets and New Jack City circa 1971. It was an urban American Lord of the Flies, and from the day the ribbon was cut on the first 20 of its 33 towers in 1954, it has been a lie. That is really powerful. And what does that say about Leon and Michael Spinks living in that environment?
Well, you know, I think it's interesting that they came from that environment. I mean, it really was quite bad. It was a complete disaster from the start. When that housing project first started, there were brochures coming out about how it was going to be an end to the slums in St. Louis. And, you know, all of the brochures made all of these promises. And when it went up, it actually ended up being a disaster. I mean, the crime that took place in Pruitt-Igoe broke was off the charts in regard to comparing it with other cities. I mean, we spoke with many of the friends of Leon and Michael who grew up there. And, you know, if you were taking the elevator, you were afraid that it would stop and you would get shot at from the top. You know, the gangs would wait on the top of the elevator and shoot into the elevator. So the fact that Pruitt-Igoe was kind of a lie, what it promised, is kind of a backdrop to what in some ways, not always, but in some ways, what the heavyweight title has been. You know, the title of the book you mentioned is One Punch from the Promised Land, Leon Spinks, Michael Spinks, and the Myth of the Heavyweight Title. And what we meant by that is there were a lot of promises that the title made to kids who were growing up in those environments. They were in Leon and Michael's day, they were looking at Muhammad Ali, they were looking at Joe Frazier, you know, George Foreman, and from the outside, it looked like, wow, if I win the heavyweight title, I'll be rich for the rest of my life. Everything will be great. You know, the country will band behind me. And in the case of Ali, he had his troubles with the draft, but he came back and won everybody over. But that's not the experience Leon and Michael really had. You know, Leon famously made a lot of money and went through it, blew through it pretty quickly. And Michael, who had a very different path. I mean, he was really the careful and conservative one. He didn't fight longer than, you know, some people say don't stick around too long. He didn't. He lost one fight. He quit the game. He retired with a lot of money. But in the long run, just recently, when Butch Lewis, his promoter and manager, passed away, he found out that the money that he thought had been set aside for him wasn't really there. So in the long run, he ended up also having a promise broken. So that's kind of the backdrop. It's funny you picked that quote because that's a backdrop to the whole book.
Was the DeSoto Rec Center kind of a refuge for both these guys?
Oh, absolutely. The DeSoto was a place where they and everybody in the area would go. They started out, you know, to protect themselves from the gangs. And then, you know, Leon and Michael got very good. They started doing well. Budweiser at that time sponsored the athletic competitions that took place in the area. So, you know, they would walk around with those jackets, and that they had like a group of their own where you were wearing that jacket back then in St. Louis. It really said something. It said, you know, these guys are, you know, taking care of themselves. They're living clean. They're not part of a gang. And the gangs left them alone because of that. So that rec center was important. And the guys who ran it, one in particular who's still out, he's at a different part rec center now. He's at 12th and Park in St. Louis. His name is Kenny Lohr. He taught them how to box when they were young. He was kind of a father figure. He would buy them and the other kids shoes when they needed it, pizza, you know, for dinner. He would take, when they went out on the road to compete, he would kind of give them some money to put in their pocket. So that DeSoto meant a lot for those kids. It was more than a boxing center. It was kind of a little clique, a little culture of their own, a little subculture within Pruitt-Igoe, within the area.
How did the family situation mold who they were and what became of them?
Well, another interesting question. You know, their mom was very religious. So, and Michael, they were both religious when they were young. Michael really took religion more seriously, it seemed, even as he became older. And, you know, that meant a lot to them when they were boxing. I know Leon used to put a cross in his sock before he would fight. And Michael would read from the Bible quite often. When that guy, Kenny Lohr, would go to pick them up, he would go to pick them up to take them for competitions. He'd have to wait outside while they were inside finishing, you know, their prayers. But the flip of that was that in Pruitt-Igoe, their father had left. And if you lived in Pruitt-Igoe, no working, able-bodied male was able to be in the house, or it was like a special situation, like, you know, subsidized housing project. So it would be taken away from them if there was an able-bodied male who was living with them. So the government would come and check for razor blades or something that a man might have had in the house, you know, a Gillette razor or something. So nobody in that area had the male role model in the house, and if he was there, he had to kind of sneak out. So, you know, they were raised without positive male father figures. And that kind of changed things for them. Michael latched on to Butch Lewis, who I mentioned before. He kind of trusted him with everything. And in the long run, that ended up maybe not being such a wise decision. But Leon, on the other hand, never had that positive role model. He was kind of wandering, kind of looking for it. I don't know that he ever really found it.
John Florio is with us. We're talking about his excellent book, and I hope you'll check it out. It's about Leon and Michael Spinks. It's called One Punch from the Promised Land. As I sat here and I'm listening to you and what I've read through in the book, I get the sense that these guys were going to be victims no matter what happened. First of all, their background, which we've already talked about. Also, the fact the time that they were involved with boxing. It was where the managers and other sleazy people of the sport took advantage of their fighters and everything. And then they didn't have the home life or the education that would have precluded something like that happening. Were they destined to have this type of outcome in their lives, in your mind, John?
Well, you know, that's a question I think that the book raises. And the question is, did they reach their destiny? You know, to say it was predestined is tough to say. Here's Michael, who did everything the way you would think he would, that someone should do it. If you were to give someone advice, you'd say to do it the way Michael did it. And in the long run, you know, he ended up getting tricked at the end when Butch Lewis wasn't there and the money was gone. So in a way, I guess you could say it was predestined, because all of the managers, all of the promoters, Butch Lewis was thought of as one of the different ones. His relationship with Michael was always looked at as one of the different ones. In the book, we interviewed Bob Arum, and Bob Arum, who had worked with Butch Lewis, said, gee, I always thought that was one of the bonds that would never be broken. So even when it seemed like something was on the up and up and everything was okay, it still in the long run ended up not being exactly what it seemed. So, yeah, I would guess that in some ways it seems like they had a very, very big challenge in front of them, let's put it that way. I don't want to say anything was predestined, but, man, it would have been a mountain to have things turn out differently.
We have 2 minutes before we have to break here, and I'm just wondering, how good of a fighters were they?
Well, you know, Michael, this, you know, the question of what something's you're born with talent or you learn it along the way, like, you know, is your kid Joe DiMaggio, or does he have to practice to become Joe DiMaggio? And if he practices, will he ever reach that level? You don't know. Leon was born, it seems, with an incredible amount of talent. Came out of the chute early and beat Muhammad Ali, but he didn't really train, and he ended up maybe squandering a lot of that away. On the flip of it, Michael, they say, came out, and he didn't really have the strength that Leon had. But from training, he ended up becoming a world champion. So, I think they were both excellent fighters. They were both champions. I think Michael, it seems, did more with his ability because he was just so, so very diligent in the gym.
Did they know how to handle what they were dealing with? I mean, as far as the notoriety, the success, all of that?
Well, Michael had the benefit of seeing what happened to Leon. So Leon, I don't think, did. Leon was a kind of... you know, everybody says he was such a great guy, and, you know, and he is. We've met him, and he's such a wonderful guy, but he's so trusting that, no, I don't think he had the skills to really discern between who should be trusted and who shouldn't. And seeing that happen, Michael looked at it and said, I'm going to be way more careful. And he only trusted one person. But in the long run, that one person may not have been the person he should have been trusting from the start.
When we come back, we're going to talk about a couple of items in this book, which is a fascinating read, and I hope you'll check it out. We'll talk about Leon before the Muhammad Ali rematch. He didn't train, and nobody could find him, drunk up until the last minute. Michael before the Mike Tyson match, afraid to come out of the dressing room, and Leon at the end of his career as manager admitting to fixing fights. There's a lot of aspects of these two men and their stories and their careers that we'll talk with John Florio about. Again, the name of this book is called One Punch from the Promised Land. And also we'll talk about the sport of boxing and where it was in our culture during the course of the time in which these two men were fighting, because I think a lot of people have seen some boxing movies. They know how they come out. They know what the message is about the sport of boxing. We continue across the country and around the world. We've got you on Sports Byline.
This is America's Sports Talk Show, Sports Byline USA. Here's Ron Barr.
John Florio is with us on Sports Byline. He has a wonderful book out about Leon and Michael Spinks. He's a co-author of this book, and it's called One Punch from the Promised Land, and I can recommend it to you. Let's talk about some of the issues I mentioned before we took a break here, that Leon Muhammad Ali rematch. I remember it, and, you know, I'm a pretty good person at reading body language, and when I saw him as far as training, I didn't think he wanted to have the Ali rematch. I mean, you know, maybe there was a lot of money involved with it, John, but I just didn't think, I don't know if he was scared or if he just didn't want to be in boxing or what it was. Give me some insight on that.
Well, you know, he won that fight and nobody, the first one, and nobody
right.
really expected that to happen. You know, he had like seven fights under his belt. He caught an aging Ali who may have already been sick at the time. You know, nobody will say that, and it's probably, he may not have had the Parkinson's syndrome, but he definitely had he was compromised to some extent. So Leon caught Ali at the right time. He was also, they used to call him the Wild Bull of Camp Lejeune when he was in the Marines, and he came out like the Wild Bull they said he was, and he plowed right through him. But Leon, being Leon, you know, went out after that and really, I think, wasn't able to handle what had just happened. I think, you know, you got a young guy and a lot of money, and it's kind of a, you know, unfortunately a typical story when young athletes make a lot of money. But he really didn't train almost at all. I mean, from what we've put together, speaking with various people involved, and, you know, in the book, I think you mentioned this, we put the interviews out there. We've interviewed about 100 people for the book, and we let them tell the story. But, you know, various people who were involved in his camp back then showed up at the camp. They were waiting for him to show up. He really didn't show up till about, you know, a month after he was supposed to. When he did, you know, they couldn't find him. He'd come, he'd work out for about half a day, he'd leave for a party, not come back 3 days later. He had bought various people, you know, cars and things like that, which are the legends that you hear. But the one story that I think is really stands out on Leon is that he was so ill-prepared for that second fight, you know, that his wife at the time, Nova, was looking for him. He was supposed to be at the arena. They couldn't find him. When she found him, he was in a hotel room, and he wasn't alone, and he wasn't sober, and the fight was going to start shortly. So she gets him over to the dressing room. This is in New Orleans. She gets him over to the dressing room, and they say, somebody says, "Where's Leon's cup?" Now, keep in mind, at this point, Ron, he's the heavyweight champion of the world, okay? They say, "Where's Leon's cup?" Somebody turns around, one of his handlers, and says, "Get Leon a cup with some ice in it." And they said, not a cup. So they said, "All right, we'll get a cup." And nobody had a cup. They didn't even have the gear for him. Now, he's got to go out and fight Ali. So what they ended up doing was they got Mike Rossman's cup from a fight that he had just had. They said, "Go get a cup, get any cup." So there was, you know, a young intern goes running in to Rossman's room and goes, "Do you have a cup?" And he says, "Well, I have this one, but I just wore it. I he had just finished a 13-round match," and he said, against Victor Galindez, and he says, "Give me that cup. I don't care." So Leon ended up wearing a cup going into the fight. I mean, he was still hungover. He's wearing a cup that's used and not his own. He gets into the corner, And, you know, Mr. T at the time was his bodyguard, the same Mr. T from the A-Team who had the TV show. And he pointed out, and if you watch the replay, you'll see it, after the first round, Leon's coming back to his corner and kind of collapsing in his corner. In the first fight, which was only 6 months earlier, Leon didn't even sit until about the sixth round. So, I mean, just that partying through that time in between the fights brought him from a guy who was, like, barely needed to rest between rounds, at least in the early rounds in the first fight, and then to needing a rest, like, immediately after in the second one. So he was a different fighter in that second fight.
Where did he lose his heart for the sport?
I don't know that he ever liked training. I mean, when you go back to the stories in the Marines, we spoke with a lot of his Marine teammates, Buster Drayton and Roger Stafford, and he never really trained. He would always duck training. You know, in the Olympics, Howard Davis told us a great story. It's in the book. Howard Davis told us a story where Leon's comes in at night. It's six in the morning, seven in the morning. They're all leaving to do their road work. Leon comes in, and he's putting water on his face and his workout jacket and his clothes to make it look like he just came in from running and he was sweating. But he never really did. He never really went out and did the road work. So he never really liked that part of the sport, the actual training, the gym time. He just liked to get in there and fight. And for that first Ali fight, you know what? He was young. He was in great shape. He was really good. And he went in there and he plowed through Ali. But it's the lack of training and the lack of love for training that caught up with him. He never really loved to train.
Was that 76 Olympic team the best we've ever fielded? Because we had Sugar Ray Leonard,
man,
on that one. Leon was there. Michael, Leo
Sugar
Randolph.
Ray.
And Sugar Ray and Howard Davis. Because Sugar Ray is a friend of mine, said to me, he said, you know, you just saw these guys and you knew they had a purpose. They were going to go out and just take care of business.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, one of the stories we have in the book is Howard Cosell really fought to get them the airtime. You know, they were on gymnastics and they were on other things. And he kept telling the producers, one of the producers working in the trucks named Terry Jastrow, he's in the book, we interviewed him. And he said, you know, Cosell's calling up and going, tell Arledge, tell those guys that the story is right here in the Rogers Center. You got to get here and you got to cover this boxing team. And as they kept winning, they realized, hey, you know, maybe Cosell's onto something. He really took a personal interest in those guys. Each one of their, you know, he always liked the individual stories. You know, like you had Leo Randolph and Davy Armstrong. Randolph won a gold. Armstrong was on the team. And they had snuck their coach in and they were sneaking food out to him so that he could stay there and watch them fight. He was in a local, I think they had him in a church basement. I think he was hiding out. And then you had, of course, Howard Davis' mom passed away, which was a tragedy. But he stayed and he fought for his mom and he won the gold. And afterwards, he wasn't even around for the victory celebration. He went straight home. You had Sugar Ray Leonard, who everybody loved. He was going to fight. And he, at the time, I think he was thinking of going back to school. He was with Juanita, and everyone was keyed in on that story. Cosell loved it, so he's saying, you know, I got to get these guys the airtime they deserve. And then by the end of the Olympics, they did get the airtime they deserved, but it wasn't easy in the beginning.
Let's talk a little bit about Michael. In the book, you talk about him being afraid to come out of the dressing room when he was fighting Mike Tyson. Pick it up from there.
Well, that was, you know, for people who remember that fight, and I do, I mean, that was a big, big fight because you had two undefeated people who could really lay claim to the championship. I mean, that hadn't happened on that scale since Ollie Frazier. You know, so you have Tyson, who was, at that time, if you wanted to knock his championships, I mean, he was plowing through everybody. I don't mean to knock it, but even he says, you know, we interviewed him, and it's in the book as well. He says, I was the alphabet soup champion until I beat the man who beat the man who beat the man, dating back to John L. Sullivan. At that time, it was Michael Spinks because he had beaten Larry Holmes. So you had these two guys getting into the ring, but Michael liked the gym. You know, they were real opposites, he and Leon. Michael loved the gym part. He liked to work out. He liked to stay in shape. He lived a very clean life, and he worked out very hard. He never really loved to fight. He never really liked the fighting aspect of it. He would say, you know, I'm fighting these guys. I don't really like getting in there. You know, I don't want to get hurt. I don't want to hurt them. And Tyson, of course, at that time was knocking out everybody in unbelievable fashion. I mean, you know, he had, right before that fight, He had beaten Trevor Burbick, and with one punch, he knocked Burbick down three times. He had knocked Burbick down. Burbick got up, and his legs were rubbery. He went down again. He got up. He went down again, all from the one punch. So, you know, it's natural that someone would be intimidated. But if you're watching that fight, there was a big, big delay before the fight, and everybody's saying, what's going on? And the first thing they reported over the air was that, well, we guessed they're both saying that they're the champion, and they each want the other one to come out first. So that was the first thing they said. And then I guess it got a little hairier from there. Larry Hazard, who was the commissioner, Jersey commissioner, was called. And what was happening was Butch Lewis had gone into Tyson's dressing room. And he said, I wasn't around to see the hands get wrapped. Nobody from our camp watched Tyson's hands get wrapped. We want them rewrapped, and we want to watch. We don't trust what's going on here. So, I mean, this is getting Tyson really angry. There's a big fight going on. Tyson turns around and punches a hole right through the wall. They're in the dressing room there, and the construction's going on, and he puts a hole through the wall. Now, this, everybody's thinking, was Butch Lewis's way of trying to get Tyson off his game. And that's what we had assumed, too. But we were interviewing a few people, and the ones that we put in the book, there's the interview with Emmanuel Stewart, who told us he was at the fight. And he said, you know, I didn't know what was going on, so I went over to this Michael's dressing room, Spinks' dressing room, and they couldn't get him to come out of the dressing room. What Butch Lewis was doing was trying to take the attention off the fact that they were trying to convince Michael to come out. He didn't want to come out. And, you know, in Butch Lewis's words, in Emmanuel Stewart's words, you know, Michael was really freaking out. He said, you know, it was like that moment to come out into the ring. He didn't want to do it. He didn't want to get in there with Tyson.
We only have a couple of minutes left, but I want to talk a little bit about something that you go into in this book, and that is the state of boxing in America in the 20th century, especially when these two guys were boxing. Tell me about the significance of it. Tell me about how it was viewed at that time.
Oh, well, you know, that the in the 20th century, the heavyweight champion really stood for something. You know, we talk in the book, we go back, we talk a little bit about Jack Johnson. We talk a little bit about Joe Louis and what he stood for, but the most applicable to the Spinks story is Ali and what he stood for. You know, he was a, well-spoken. He represented his race. He represented the country. He stood for a lot of things. You know, he was anti-war. He was very clear what his beliefs were. And, he kind of had one phase where he was, you know, turned down the draft, where he rejected the draft, and he kind of went from a draft dodger. But then, you know, as time went on, he was kind of reinvented in history, and he kind of became someone who had stood up against the Vietnam War and stood up for his religion. So whatever anybody's beliefs were at the time about Ali, it was very clear what he stood for. Heavyweight champion almost had to stand for something. I mean, even Sonny Liston, you know, had a certain air about him and things that he stood for. So when Leon came along, it was unfortunate for him that he wasn't interested in any of these things. He wasn't really well-spoken. And he had the misfortune of beating Muhammad Ali. As great a feat as that was, he had incredible shoes to fill. So as a result, you know, people really expected a lot, and they really didn't get it from him. And then after that, you had Larry Holmes took over, and he was there for a while. And then Tyson was kind of the last of those champions. You know, after that, the championship kind of broke up as a result of all the different organizations and different. You know, you had the different WBA, WBC, and it's kind of splintered. But it seemed like Leon and Michael were right there in the midst of that golden era of great heavyweights. The problem is neither one of the other side. I shouldn't say the problem, but the counterpoint to that is that neither one of them really stood for anything specific. Michael was a very, very quiet kind of guy. He was a wallflower. Leon was, you know, the flip of it. He was out. He spoke a lot, but he really didn't stand for anything. And the country was really wanted, I think, more, expected more out of a heavyweight championship. But of course, the question is why. I mean, he's a heavyweight champion. We talk about Richard Pryor in the book, and his quote is, I'll be bleeped if I say it on the air, but his quote says, well, basically, you know, you're the heavyweight champion of the world, and you knock people out. We're not expecting you to be an anthropologist. You know?
We only have about 30 seconds left, but what do you want people to take away from this book?
Well, that's a really good question. I'd like people, first of all, to take a look at Leanne and Michael and realize how much they've done, the mountains they climbed and the odds they broke. And I think the second thing is I'd like them to ask the question of what is the value of the heavyweight championship and why do we necessarily project the things we do on the people who hold it?
John, congratulations on the book. We're going to make it a selection of the month on the Sports Byline USA Book Corner. And, again, you're welcome here anytime. So thanks a lot for joining us, John.
Thanks very much for having us on the show.
John Florio with us, co-author of the book Leon and Michael Spinks, about those two brothers. And it's called One Punch from the Promised Land. The book uncovers stories never made public, including their big paydays, the high living, and the backroom deals, as well as Leon's parting before the Ali fight, Michael's fear of getting in the ring with Mike Tyson, and Leon's mysterious bottle during the Ali fight. And I remember watching both of their fights, or the ones that we were talking about in this book, and you could just tell that something was not right with these two fighters. We continue with more of You and Sports Byline.